And now, coming to you live from the Radio Bunker somewhere in Arizona, it's time for the best 90 minutes in digital media, Article 5 Live. I'm your host, JD. Thanks for joining us this fine Sunday night. And it is Sunday, September 20th, 2020. 1,342 days into the Trump administration, only 43 days until the most important election in the history of the world. Indeed. Let us get to work here. Hi, welcome to Article 5 Live, episode number 3. We have a lot on the table tonight for you. First, our first guest will be Mr. John O'Connor. I'll tell you more about him in just a minute. And then we're trying to get a hold of our other guest, Mr. Bobby Lawrence. We haven't been able to find him yet, but just let me open with a few things. The Dems freak out over the death of RBG and the possibility of new justice being appointed by Donald J. Trump. It is quite rich to listen to them and watch them squirm, because you know as well as I do that they would do to us what we're about to do to them. And you know, I don't take any real pleasure in that. I wish justices of the Supreme Court were a lot less, politicized. But what on God's green earth is not politicized now? In this day and age, and this started some time ago. We're going to get into that directly. Now, I want to talk about the Arizona Senate race for just a minute, because now it is front and center. And let me explain why. Many of you may not know that Martha McSally is an appointed senator who lost to a communist. So we have a Republican senator who was appointed, who lost to a communist, who's now running against an astronaut. This is a special election in the state of Arizona. This is to finish deceased John McCain's term. So they do not have to wait till the new Congress to install the new senator. So when we go through elections here in the state of Arizona, everywhere else in the country, November the 3rd, if Martha McSally loses to Mark Kelly, the Democrat, astronaut, gun grabber, which could happen, then he could be installed in the United States Senate as soon as December the 1st. A lot of people don't realize that. So that takes the count on the Republican side down one more. This is amazing times we live in indeed. So that's why Arizona Senate race is front and center. The polls show McSally with a very slight advantage at this point in time, depending on which poll you look at. I just wanted to throw that in there to let people realize the critical nature of what we're facing right now. We have a lot of weak Republicans that in the Senate that could fold in such a time. And all this has, of course, erased COVID gate, Russia gate, Biden gate, and mail-in ballot gate, and all the other kind of gates we might have here. And to help us sort through some of these things, someone who has absolutely all kinds of experience with the mother of all gates, Watergate, Mr. John O'Connor is with us. He is a former assistant U.S. attorney in Northern California, representing the United States in both criminal and civil cases. Yeah, he did that from 74 to 79. Among his interesting assignments have been representation of the government during the OPEC oil embargo of the 70s. Many of you remember that, writing Fifth Amendment and State of Mind briefs for the prosecution in the United States versus Patricia Hearst of Helter Skelter fame, and FDIC, RT, many, many, many other things. He has a very long bio, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but most importantly, he has a new book, and it's Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. Goodness, let's bring John on. John, how you doing? Nice to meet you, sir.
Good to see you, JD.
Hey, it's great to have you on the show, and I can hear you just fine. It's a wonderful thing to meet you. I want to thank you and your publicist for sending me a copy of your fascinating book, and I am not kissing your butt calling it fascinating. It is fascinating. I was a kid. I lived through all that stuff, and all those names brought back the uncertainty, because I was political even when I was a teenager. I'm such a weirdo. So I was paying attention to this stuff when I was 12, 13, 14, 15 years old. It was eerily familiar to start reading the story. Now, the book goes into great detail about all of these things. So why don't you tell us the Reader's Digest version of the message you're trying to get across to your audience with your great new book, Postgate?
Yeah, JD, let me tell you this. I followed this quite closely, and I thought that the Post reporting was as good as it could be. It won Pulitzer Prizes, and yet, hold, many years later, after I examined this, I find out that the only president of the United States to be removed from office prior to his term.
One second, John. We're having a slight problem with your audio. Is there any way you can get closer to the mic or something like that? Because we're
Yeah, let me see if this is better.
That's much better as far as the audio is concerned. We can hear you a lot better. Go ahead, sir. Okay, I'm sorry.
I'll try to get it closer so we don't have this ringing and so forth. But let me tell you this, JD. We removed the president, and what I show in my book, and this is stunning to me because I was as close a student of this as you could get. I figured out who Deep Throat was. I was a prosecutor at the time. And now, after I looked at this and I printed out 3,000 Post articles and compared it to what was known or knowable at the time, and I will tell you that the whole country was defrauded very bluntly and as clearly as I can say it. So now, if you can remove a president, the journalism profession now has political power. And that's what the lesson was. The lesson was let's tell the truth as well as we can tell it. It's how we can use our political power to affect politics. And that is what I showed. And once you read this, it's a very good, intriguing read. And I have gone through it and I've written it like a thriller. Because I didn't know what was up until many, many years later. But the scary thing about it is that now we have a meeting that has all emulated Woodward and Bernstein, and they're now trying to do a reprise of this and try to affect the present election, rather than simply reporting the facts. Now, we saw the Russiagate deal, in which both sides were not told. There were many facts that were withheld. Ukraine, all the corruption of Biden was not promulgated, was not published. So we have a situation, if we have a democracy where the citizens depend on information from the media, and they do not get the truth. So what I'm trying to say is, if you read Postgate, and I'm not doing money, believe me, I've lost more money than I could ever make by book sales. Believe me, I'm doing this for a purpose. I want people to understand how they can be defrauded by the media. And that's my message, and it's happening now. And Bob Woodward is working now with rage, which is ridiculous. So that's my intro to you, JD. And I hope you know where I stand.
Yeah, I think I do. This is John O'Connor, everybody. He's the author of the great new book, Postgate. And let me read the subtitle, because that's very important in case you didn't hear it before. How the Washington Post betrayed Deep Throat, covered up Watergate, and began today's partisan advocacy journalism. And boy, howdy, is journalism about partisan advocacy. That is such an understated thing at the okay. Go ahead. Go ahead and continue with your experience and how did they, who is Deep Throat and how did they betray him and what, why do you think they did that? That's one of the important points in your book.
Well, here's the deal.
Mark Felt was the number two guy in the FBI and headed the Watergate investigation. He gave a lot of information to Woodward, and more importantly, gave him analysis of what was going on. Woodward reported, and Bernstein reported half of what Deep Throat told him, but omitted the other half, which would have mitigated and extenuated the guilt of Richard Nixon. So, in essence, they defrauded us. If I tell you, JD, that I've got this wonderful land for you to buy because you want to grow alfalfa, and you can hit water at 20 feet and there's plenty of it year round, and you buy the land, and I omit to tell you the other half of the story, which is that the water is permeated with toxins, I have defrauded you.
All right.
Okay? Woodward and Bernstein, let me just say this very bluntly and very clearly, Woodward and Bernstein and the Washington Post defrauded the American public during Watergate. And that is the thrust of my book. And if any of your audience reads this, they will see it in spades. And this, think about this, this is a major fraud on American society, on American history. Everything now is called a gate if there's a scandal. And Carl Bernstein gets on CNN and says this is worse than Watergate. Well, worse than Watergate means something to me, but it doesn't mean what it means to Carl Bernstein. What it means to me is this is a media falsehood worse than Watergate. That's what it means to me. So that is why this is so important, and your audience should learn how important it is to know that the modern media gave birth to their present, quote, investigative journalism based on fraud. And that's where it's gone.
It's amazing. And, you know, the problem with people trusting the media is it's just so ingrained in people that are always on one level. They never dig into it because it's, you know, we have lives and we expect to not be lied to by the people who profess all this First Amendment protection. We don't expect them to be advocates for criminal activity and cover-ups. And, you know, so when they accuse people of being criminals and covering things up, such as what happened with the Watergate break-in and whatnot, we're focused on that. And we only know what they tell us. The lie by omission is the death knell to the to truth in media since, you know, at least since the Watergate era and maybe even before. Of course, we don't want to mix yellow journalism with media political advocacy, but I you know, the Spanish-American War was caused by yellow journalism by the Hearst organization. So the problems along these lines are not new, but they are insidious. Your comments.
Well,
now we lost you almost altogether, sir.
Right. What I would say is
wow, your audio's gone, John.
What?
Your audio's almost gone. I need to be right up on that phone.
Okay, I'll try it again. Am I okay here?
That's much better.
Approbation, basically people disapproving of it. Until Watergate, this investigative stuff was considered second class. It was considered muckraking. But now it's considered quite regular journalism where news and opinion are mixed. And now if you hate the president, you can just come in and say anything you want about it. So there has been a sea change since Watergate. There's no doubt about it.
Yes, I think there's been definitely an intensification and more boundaries broken as far as lying by omission, what I call it, you know, they only tell you a part of the story that they want you to know, and they enhance and embellish certain segments of that and diminish other segments, gives a total different picture than if you would have known both sides. Not unlike how you depicted what happened with Deep Throat in your book, Postgate, because and Woodward's reluctance to write a second book with Mark Felt and give him the credit while he was still alive. I found that absolutely appalling. And, you know, Woodward sees to me a slime ball of the lowest order.
Well, yes. And of course, you get
that. Oh, boy. Right in the mic if you can. I don't, we're losing.
Am I close? Am I good here?
Yeah, be close.
Okay. Woodward did it, of course, for the money, but he did it for a second reason. He did not want somebody coming in and telling the public what the real truth was about Mark Felt. That's his real motivation.
Yeah.
We now have a situation in which a president can be impeached without people understanding that Joe Biden was very corrupt in Ukraine. Did you hear anything about it? No. But the evidence of that corruption is very great. But the CNN and MSNBC and the other major media outlets did not tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah. They really didn't. And it's really frustrating as somebody that pays attention to these things. I don't really know how they get away with it. It's really quite frustrating. And the people around that I know that are not politically minded are not paying that much attention. So it goes unnoticed. And they use the old Soviet tactics of repeating lies over and over again. They become the truth.
That's right, JD. They do become the truth. And also, because even though we have a very active internet, we have a lot of talk radio, the fact is that there's so much information out there that the truth gets lost very much. So the major media can now drown out all the, quote, noise, and they get to have the signal, and they get to tell people what's what. And so all people know is that G in the Ukraine thing, Trump must have been going after his political rival, rather than saying there was some real corruption over there, which enabled Putin to take over Ukraine, which he is doing as we speak. And but the American public doesn't get that. So we do not have a real truthful presentation.
Yeah, that's true. And I think you have really laid out some interesting things in your book, John. And I want to go to a video real quick and see if we can't straighten these audio problems out that we're having while I play for the audience a video.
Attorney General Barr told federal prosecutors to consider charging rioters and others who had committed violent crimes at protests in the past few months with sedition. Sedition, which is the act of inciting revolt or violence against a lawful authority with the goal of destroying or overthrowing the government. Exactly what has transpired at police stations and courthouses across the country for months.
It's a serious felony punishable by fines and up to 20 years in prison.
Of course, okay. The Mockingbird media found Barr's suggestion preposterous.
He's now talking about sedition cases. Explain what that would look like and tell us what the Attorney General is trying to achieve.
Of course, when I heard that, I thought, well, how exactly is that defined? Is it defined in a very clear way, or is this sort of a catch-all that runs the risk of trampling on First Amendment rights?
These so-called Black Lives Matter people, now that as a proposition, who can quarrel with the proposition Black Lives Matter? But they're not interested in Black lives. They're interested in props. A small number of blacks who were killed by police during conflict with police, usually less than a dozen a year, who they can use as props to achieve a much broader political agenda.
He's describing groups like Black Lives Matter, like Antifa, as being very sort of fringe or radical in some sense, and driven by political goals, which, you know, may not be completely may not completely comport with, you know, what else we're seeing these groups doing.
My man, you up real bad.
All right, John, can you hear me now? Can you hear me, John?
Yes, I can, but I hear a lot of other stuff in the background.
Yeah, that's the video. We're live right now. Okay. So let's watch the rest of the video, and then I'll get you right back on the air. We'll go with the Bluetooth then.
Fantastic.
Go. Andrew Weissman, I think we can put an umbrella over this attorney general that just reads abuse of power and put many, many things under it, especially after last night.
You can't put people in like Bill Barr who want to create an autocratic president.
And liberal water carrier FBI Director Wray added cover for the treasonous scum terrorizing our cities and its citizens, with a death toll of at least 30, roughly 800 police officers injured, and roughly $1 billion in damage in its wake during a pandemic.
Recent report indicated between $1 and $2 billion of insurance claims will be paid out. That doesn't even come close to measuring the actual and true damage done to people's lives. Not even close. That's just insurance. We've heard multiple reports of small businesses without any insurance whatsoever. Some of these will never open up, even if they did get insurance payments. Correct.
All right, you guys, let's hold it right there and let's get back to John. And thanks for your patience. I think that we now can. Probably be just fine with the Bluetooth connection. John O'Connor joins us. How are you doing, John?
Well, I hope you can hear me okay, JD. I apologize if it's my fault on my end. You know, modern communications.
Well, yeah, and we got a lot of things going on. We got stream going out to YouTube. We got stream going out to Facebook three different ways. We're out on Twitter, and we're out on Podbean Live, and I'm running the studio myself and trying to talk to you. So when things go wrong, it's hard for me to fix it right away. But thanks for your patience.
Well, we get these echoes all the time. I mean, I do a lot of these things, and we do echoes, and sometimes you can correct them, and sometimes you can't, and it's just too bad. But, hey, the main thing is that your audience can really kind of get what we're saying here, and hopefully we can have a meaningful dialogue here.
Yes, indeed. And let's give a quick overview of what we already covered. Because it was difficult to understand, but we're talking with John O'Connor, author of Postgate, How Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. Wow, that's a mouthful, and I couldn't have said it better myself, that's for sure. And I can remember all that we were taught that Richard Nixon was the most evil person on planet Earth, and now the never-ending holy grail for the press corps is to find another Watergate that they can hang around a Republican's neck, basically, because they don't seem to go after Democrats anywhere nearly as enthusiastically. Wouldn't you say? That's just my observation. What do you think, sir?
Well, one of the outcomes of Watergate was that because journalists got political power because of that. Remember, journalists ousted a president. And as I have told you before, JD, they did so fraudulently. They did not tell the public all of the facts. If the public knew all of the facts, perhaps Richard Nixon would have gotten some shame on him, but there would have been a very good chance he could have survived. But the public would have voted on that. That's the most important thing. If the public thought it was bad with all the facts, that's fine. But they didn't have all the facts. So that's where we are. And that's what's going on today, is that the media is trying to get people to make decisions without having all the facts. And but at the same time, trying to convince people that they do have all the facts.
Yeah.
So that's where we are today.
And yeah,
that's what's so terrible.
Yeah, it is terrible because it's such a it's, and usually there's a certain percentage of truth with the way the media is presenting things. So it makes it harder to find out that you're not getting the whole story because they tell just enough and they to lead you down the path that they want you to think about current events. So this is, it is so absolutely essential to have a historic perspective so that you can judge current events on. And this is one of the reasons your work on Postgate is so prescient, because of all the current things going on. Now, I have a question. Now, forgive me, because I've only been able to read about a third of your book, but it seems to me Richard Nixon was not going to have any problem whatsoever getting reelected. So why did these boneheads decide to pull this caper off in 1972 prior to his reelection? I mean, it seems counterproductive because they were so far ahead anyway. Why would it, what was the motivation for the Watergate break-in to begin with?
Well, you just said it perfectly, JD. We all think today, and it's in the textbooks, that Richard Nixon did this, number one, or that his administration did it, and number two, he did it as part of the campaign. It made no sense. Nobody could figure it out. He was way ahead, and the DNC had no information. But I'm here to tell you, and I want all your listeners and audience to listen to me, because I'm going to tell you something they probably haven't heard in 50 years. This had nothing to do with the campaign. This was about, and read my book, and it's amazing, because this is part of American history, and it's based on a fraud. I mean, if we ended up saying the Civil War is based on a fraud, or you name it, World War I was based on a fraud, to be a victim. This is the only time a president's left office before his term, and it was based on fraud. Basically, the CIA was behind this. I read my book. I'm not making this up. It sounds very conspiracy theorist, and of course, we hate to do that. Oh, we don't want to be a conspiracy theorist. No, the CIA was behind this. I've proven this 10 times over. I'm a federal prosecutor. I know what I'm doing. And some low-level people in the White House thought they could get some dirt on Democrats. This was all about, A, the CIA wiretapping important men and girls that were doing things for money. Okay? That's what this was about. The CIA has been about that for many years. It's always been illegal when they did it in the United States. And they wanted to do it through the White House so that they would have the tincture of legality. Now what happens is they get arrested. So what do? The CIA acts like they had nothing to do with this. No, this has had nothing to do with the CIA. The CIA had infiltrated the White House. They'd infiltrated the campaign. Read my book. I mean, if you come out of this and you don't believe me, I'll send you your money back. Anybody can just do it. Just send me an email and I'll send you your money back if I haven't proven my case. So what happened was, now they get arrested and the CIA realizes, hey, we can't admit this is a CIA operation. The young White House people who okayed it because they thought they would cover themselves in glory by getting dirt on some Democrats in the DNC that had nothing to do with the campaign. It was just basically dirt. They thought they would be cool. They're not going to admit it. They acted like they had nothing to do with it. The CIA acted like it had nothing to do with it. Richard Nixon didn't know what the heck had happened. Now, John Dean talks him into covering it up. And, of course, Nixon thinks he's probably covering up for one of his men who did something stupid. He could never figure it out. So he tries to cover up something about which he knows nothing. But as it turns out, he was the victim. He was the victim in this. It's as if somebody had done something on behalf of JD, apparently on behalf of JD, and you knew nothing about it. You might be tempted to say, to do something to cover it up. even though you knew nothing about it, even though you couldn't figure it out, well, maybe, you know, one of my friends did it on my behalf. You don't know. So that's what happened in Watergate. Richard Nixon really was in the dark. And then Woodward and Bernstein was not in the dark. The Post was not in the dark. And I proved that. They knew everything that was going on. They knew what was being listened to. Naughty talk was being listened to. And the CIA was involved in setting up the naughty talk that was being listened to. But the public, and if you're in 7th grade or 11th grade and you read about Watergate, it's about a bungled campaign operation. And nobody can figure out, why are we doing this? I'm here to tell you, 50 years later, this is what's so stunning about it. I'm not crazy. I've been practicing law for 48 years at the highest parts of the United States. I'm a former U.S. attorney. Assistant U.S. attorney. And I've tried about 70 cases in federal courts and state courts throughout the country. This is a stunning fraud. I did not know about it until recently, until the Post had put my head in the dumpster, until I finally decided I would start figuring out what was going on here. And because of my relationship with Deep Throat, I was his lawyer and writing books about it. I got curious about things, and the Post was weird. And now I have found out why they were weird and why they were covering up things with me. And it's because they had committed fraud. And I will say that again, fraud. I'm repeating myself because I want to say, I say that advisedly, deliberately. Read my book. It's incredible. Now, the entire history of modern America was changed because of that. Richard Nixon was out. Basically, it ushered in Jimmy Carter, and all sorts of things happened from that. And now, of course, we still have Carl Bernstein and other people and Bob Woodward coming on TV and talking about, oh, this is worse than Watergate. And of course, it's always about a Republican. Oh, this is worse than Watergate. And that once again, a Republican president is doing terrible things. And it's all BS. You know, it is, they understood that journalists have political power, and if you exercise political power, you get a mansion, you get a book, you get a movie, you get prominence, you're considered cool. Young journalists went to journalism school so that they could be just like Woodward and Bernstein and, quote, change the world. And guess what? It was always the conservatives that were the bad guys.
Yeah.
And that's what's gone on here. And now what we have, let me give you an example. This is very concrete. We have a president who was impeached because he wanted to investigate Joe Biden and Hunter Biden for corruption. Oh, you're doing that because you just want to investigate a political rival. I have two things to say. Number one, for 3 years, the other people have investigated Trump as a political rival with no basis. Okay. And for 3 years, you had Russiagate. Now, was there a basis to investigate Joe Biden? Not as a political candidate, but as Joe Biden. Vice president, and yes, there was. And there was probably 5.6 billion with a B, not millions, but billion in fraud that was engineered by John Kerry and Joe Biden that Hunter Biden took advantage of, and John Kerry's son-in-law, Christopher Hines, took advantage of. My point is, I'm not here to prove all the case about Hunter Biden and Joe Biden,
right,
other than to say that as a prosecutor, I will tell you this. There was very much reasonable cause to investigate Joe Biden for corruption.
Right.
The State Department talking point said that Trump was to tell the president he needed to root out corruption. Rooting out corruption was in our national interest. Now Trump gets on the phone and tries to root out corruption. And of course, it happens to be with one of his rivals. And all of a sudden, that's terrible. Now, if the public thinks that Joe Biden and Hunter Biden are just innocent lambs, that's a terrible thing for Trump to do. It makes it look like he's just doing this to hurt his rival. On the other hand, if there's a real basis for it, then all of a sudden Trump's doing the right thing for the American people. Which is it?
Well, it's both. Because, you know, let's be honest, when you're in politics and you're trying to get reelected, you're going to use dirt on your opponent. But there's nothing wrong with that. That's the way politics has been since the dawn of time. So there's nothing inherently evil of telling the truth about your opponent's criminality. I listened to an interview with Rudy Giuliani on this subject today, and he went back 30 years. And here's what the press gives us about Joe Biden and the Biden crime family's criminality. Here's what you hear from the press. You know, so the thing of it is, John, your point about this whole affair of the Watergate, the cover up of the Watergate cover up, if you will, right? Giving spawn to the evil we have going on in the media now, I think you really hit the nail on the head. And, you know, the problem, too, I see is it's not just the Washington Post. Now, I don't even know if they're the kingpin here. You hear things like happening on Fox News the other day on Harris Faulkner's show, where they're talking to Newt freaking Gingrich, right? And he's quoting a New York Times headline, all right? And he said he's talking about George Soros funding BLM and whatnot. And you have Melissa telling, we don't need to be talking about George Soros, and the Democrat on there saying, yeah, I agree, we don't need to talk about George Soros. And then there was 10 seconds of uncanny silence. This is Fox News. They can't even talk about a headline in the New York Times that implicates George Soros funding BLM, because the general public's not supposed to hear that, even if the New York Times wrote it. This is so absurd. What are we supposed to do other than be our, everybody needs to be a journalist, I guess. Right, John?
Well, that's the problem. But only a few of us have access to the major media. We have a monopoly on the airwaves, and basically the Post, the Times, and USA Today, along with the Journal, which is now controlled by the Murdoch sons, not by Rupert.
Right.
And so now we have a monopoly, essentially, and it affects Fox, is what you're saying. And I will tell you, I know that for a fact. I'm not going to tell you how I know it, but I know that for a fact. And so we have a question where we actually are keeping the public from knowing facts. Isn't it important? And the Founding Fathers talked about this in the Federalist Papers, J.D., the only way to avoid factionalism or mobocracy was to have a free and fair press that really put out all the facts. We don't have that today. We don't have it, ironically enough, in spite of the internet and all this other stuff. The internet becomes noise that cancels itself out, and you have a few major media outlets that kind of control the story. And that's unfortunate, but that's what we've got. And we all have to be, the more we are educated about the fraud that's going on. And I say that when Trump says it's fake news, I say, no, it's not fake news. It's worse. It's fraudulent journalism. It's not fake, because fake is kind of like, I think of it as being like the Onion, where you're just making stuff up out of whole cloth. No, this is very, very skillful fraudulent journalism, in which you tell half truths, make it sound like you say, you throw out some facts there that seem like they're there. It's not completely made up, but like they say in my example about buying land with the toxic water on it, you got to tell the whole truth. Enron executives are in jail because they didn't tell the whole truth. When journalists don't tell the whole truth, they get full of surprise. That's what we have today. It is our biggest problem. Let me tell you that, JD. It's our biggest problem, because you can't have, on the masthead of the Washington Post, is said, democracy dies in darkness. And it's obvious to me that part of the impetus for darkness comes from the Washington Post. I mean, they're indicting themselves. They are darkening things for the people that are listening to this, to our conversation here. They're not being told the truth. And I wish it were not so. I really do.
We're speaking with Mr. John O'Connor, author of the new book, Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate. Yeah, let that sink in. And began today's partisan advocacy journalism. Mr. O'Connor is a former assistant U.S. attorney, former lawyer for Mark Felt, who was Deep Throat, and his family, and many other things in his bio. And John, I just want to add, my goodness, how How are we supposed to? We talked earlier about historic reference for current events, and let's go back even to the founding of our nation and the First Amendment and the intent behind the First Amendment. When our founders wrote the First Amendment, they didn't envision the press advocating for criminal government activity and criminal political activity. They envisioned the press as exposing that to the public. That is the paradigm shift that's occurred. And that is why we have an amendment process to the Constitution. We need to fix the First Amendment so journalism is once again an honorable and responsible profession. What say you about that?
Well, I don't know if we can do anything by changing the First Amendment. I think we got to keep it. The question is, what do we do to get the real, to have competition in the marketplace of ideas?
Well, let me just jump back to why I said the First Amendment. I didn't mean to imply that we should get rid of the First Amendment. What I do think, though, is we should be a little bit more specific about what the press is allowed to do and what they are not allowed to do. They should not be able to spread falsehoods far and wide for political gain and advocate for one side or the other in that regard and cover up criminality. I think that ought to be a crime in and of itself. There ought to be some sort of truth in advertising mechanism installed. If you want to call yourself a journalist, that should come with some responsibility for telling the truth. I don't know exactly how to word that because I am not a lawyer, but I'm sure there are sharp lawyers who could figure out how to incorporate that into the First Amendment, which is what I was talking about. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I agree with you on that one. And one of the worst things that happened, even though I was in favor of, was New York Times versus Sullivan, in which basically a media outlet could say anything it wanted, and as long as you couldn't prove it was just absolutely reckless and knew everything they said was false, you couldn't sue them. Now, here's the problem. Most of the fraud, JD, that happens in the press is not because of affirmative misstatements. This lamp is green. That's, if you can prove that's wrong, that's an affirmative misstatement. But if you say, you know, that Joe Biden, I'm trying to give it maybe I'll think of a better example. If you say, yeah, Richard Nixon tried to burglarize the DNC, but you don't tell them, the people, that the CIA was really behind it, you're defrauding them. So how do we do this? How do we change New York Times versus Sullivan, which I think has to be changed judicially, so that people can, you know, sue when someone has said something that is false by omission, and as opposed to being truthful in the limited representations that they're making? It's a very, very tough thing. I think what we really need to do, I think the real remedy to this whole thing is for the citizenry to rise up and in unison say, and it's not going to be, it's going to be 50% of the country, rising up and basically saying, you guys are defrauding us. We know it. You've got to do better or we're not going to watch you. We're not going to patronize your advertisers, and you've got to start getting truthful with them. I think that's the only way to do it, frankly. I've been thinking about this for a long, long time.
Well, what about this? I agree with that too. But what about this idea? Right now, major mainstream legacy news outlets are owned by five major mega corporations. What about antitrust being applied to information and news dissemination in the United States to where we break these big old conglomerates up and allow competition between local news markets and smaller national news outlets so that people have a choice what they listen to? Because now you have no, unless you listen to conservative talk radio, you don't have anything but one view. one perspective presented to you. It's they're all in unison. They're in lockstep in their perspective and how they present news items to the general public. So unless you have initiation of curiosity in and of yourself, everyone out there listening, you're not going to know anything but what they tell you. And I think that's the god-awful shame of it all. What about adding antitrust? Is that even possible?
Well, now you're starting to act like a brilliant lawyer, Jimmy. I got to say this. I mean, you've just said something that to me is stunningly brilliant. And I hadn't thought in these terms. I had sometimes thought that these people have an antitrust lock on things. I've done some antitrust work myself. I think you're onto something. And I'm not really familiar enough with the way networks work, and could you get competing networks to ABC, CBS, and NBC? How easy would that be? But I think you're onto something, because right now you get NBC, ABC, CBS. You turn on the Sunday talk shows, nothing new under the sun. Even Fox is turning squishy on us for the reasons I talked about. CNN and MSNBC, it's just ridiculous. Now, they would say, well, gee whiz, you can get other cable channels and you can do things with those cable channels. And so I don't know the answer to that, and I don't know enough about the business, but I think what you have said is absolutely brilliant, because there is, in fact, and William Barr said this, there, in fact, is a monolithic media. It is acting as one body. It's just, there's no competition there. There's no interchange of ideas. So what you said and what William Barr said are very, very much similar. I don't know what to do about it. I got to say, it may well be that because of all these, you know, you have 17,000 channels now, and people could have their own channel and say whatever they wanted. Now, no, they're not going to reach anybody. I don't know enough about it. But interestingly enough, Elizabeth Warren is trying to break up some of the other companies, the tech people, because they, too many of them, you know, are saying things that she thinks are wrong about, you know, that actually might actually be conservative. But I think that you're onto something, and we don't want to force people to say certain things. We just want to have competition. Most people that are conservative, I call them traditionalists. We're not really conservative as much as we are all caring about the American tradition, whether it's liberal. We're kind of all in favor, really, a liberal democracy. Liberal meaning free speech.
Yeah. Let me just say this. I got in big trouble on social media for saying that conservatism is actually the preservation of the liberal concepts laid out in the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. And people attacked me for that, but they don't even know what the word liberal means. They think liberal are these idiots that call themselves progressives that are nothing but fascists. And the stunning degree of myths and lack of education in poli-sci in the general public has led us to a place where people don't even know our own government. Now, granted, our government is complicated as hell because it was invented by geniuses. But, you know, it behooves each individual to know our Constitution and our terms. And Thomas Jefferson was quite the classic liberal. And when I made my post on Facebook and said that I was a conservative and a liberal, people thought I didn't know what I was talking about. And the contrary is true, because liberal has been co-opted by, you know, talk show hosts that frankly should take the Hillsdale College courses that advertise on their own talk shows, because it's apparent to me that they haven't had those courses. Go ahead.
Progressives are not liberal. And I think Gary Wills said it years ago. He was sort of a conservative guy that became liberal, but he said, look, conservative, the whole idea of conservatism is we're supposed to conserve our liberal tradition.
Exactly.
It is what we're preserving is free speech, free contract, somebody can't come in and say, oh, no, you have to hire this guy or that guy. Free contract, freedom, freedom, freedom. And that's the liberal tradition. And we have a marketplace of ideas where ideas can clash, you can say whatever you want. That's the liberal tradition, which conservatives are trying to conserve. And it goes back to Edmund Burke in England. He's trying to conserve. Everybody acts like Edmund Burke is conservative. He was trying to conserve liberal values.
So you agree today, with everything I just said, apparently. You're backing me up on that.
I am backing you up 100%. And it is very rare, JD, that people understand that concept. You have got your finger on it, which is that conservatives are really conserving a liberal tradition. And what we are doing, we are moving into progressive fascism. Fascism, and I say fascism, it can be anything else. It can be any kind of communism. But anything in which speech is controlled. We now have cancel cultures. We have people who say you can't. We have politically correct speech. That's not liberalism. When we go on campuses and we teach people that the only way to think about feminism is this way, or the only way to think about racism is this way, that is really not liberal. It's a lot of things, and maybe people like it and so forth, but it's not liberal. And I think we all want to be, and what we should all call it is classical liberalism. We really shouldn't call ourselves conservatives. We should call ourselves classical liberals.
Right.
That's what we are.
Well, and you know, far be it for me to criticize, you know, Rush and Sean and all the, and Levin and all the great conservative spokespeople on the right on radio, which is a, you know, our precious counterbalance to the 99% view on the other side. But it really is important for people to know this. And what distresses me so much is the average lack of education on this subject amongst the average patriot has no idea of what we're just talking about. And I'm not trying to say that I'm smart or anything. You know, Mr. O'Connor, you're talking to a man with a high school education. Okay. I do have some community college in history, and I've studied Hillsdale College, but I've been a political junkie for 50 years. So I'm a nut job. I'm not the average high school student, if you know what I'm saying. But it's obvious to me that if one is curious, the means to find these things out about how our government works and what do these terms actually mean and who is misusing them, maybe intentionally or not intentionally, or who is using them correctly. And these kinds of things can be found out, especially with the advent of the internet, because although you have to use much discernment when researching things on the internet, the information is there for everyone to have at your fingertips, in your back pocket. So today, there's no real reason to be not informed in the manner we're talking about. And I believe that what has contributed to the lack of clarity on these issues is exactly what you laid out in your great book, Postgate, about how advocacy journalism was started. The root of really took off with this Watergate cover-up that the Washington Post covered up the true half or the more important half of the events that happened at the Watergate Hotel and who was behind it and why it really happened. Because like you said, let's go back to the timing. Chronology is all important here. This is a time where Richard Nixon was set up to win the absolute biggest landslide in the history of United States presidential elections. Why in the hell would anybody risk that by breaking into the DNC and putting a bug in there? It makes zero sense now. It made zero sense then. But yet we were fed that crock of, you know what? And so here we are today, many layers past that, being lied to by the likes of Koppel and all the big classics all over the years, perpetuating. They didn't actually lie, but they're such cunning individuals that their narrative is presented to us with enough truth that they have plausible deniability. Any comments on that, soliloquy?
Well, what I would say is I would go one further than you, JD. You're absolutely correct. First of all, you don't need to have a college education on this thing. It's a lot of nonsense that you do. You just need to have common sense. Common sense is what I want in my jurors. Common sense is what we should have here in America. It doesn't make any difference. Are you do you have common sense and you understand the English language? You're fine. So the real question is what is fraud? And fraud is not just simply saying some things that are believable insofar as they go. Are you telling the whole truth? And if you're not telling the whole truth, you're committing fraud. And that is the essence of what I'm trying to tell people. And interestingly enough, today we have a culture in which it is very difficult to portray the truth because there is not true debate. If you go on CNN or MSNBC, or even for that matter, for CBS or any of the major stations, do you see a debate in which somebody is allowed to lay out the opposite case? No, you are not. You are not allowed to do that. And so what happens is our system is built on, like the German philosopher Hegel said, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. That's the way it works. Advocacy, you have an adversarial system. One person says one thing, the prosecutor says one side, the defense says the other side, and the jury decides. Here, we don't get to hear one side. It's as if the people that are listening to CNN and MSNBC are jurors with only one lawyer coming into court and with no judge. And if you have one lawyer coming into court with no judge and no opponent, what's going to happen? The one lawyer that comes in is going to say some things and the jury's going to decide, and you don't have anybody saying, wait a second, that's not true. Or you forgot this, or you didn't say this. Or the judge says you're saying it wrongly. No, you don't have any of that today. And that is the thing that you have hit on so astutely that is in a basic, very, very basic common sense way. America was built on common sense.
And people being able to decide for themselves what the truth is by listening to two sides, which was used to be the way. And let me just give you an example of what you just pointed out. That I was talking about earlier, I was listening to the radio and there was a radio broadcast of one of the Sunday shows. I forget which one, but there was a woman interviewing Dr. Scott Gottlieb. And she asked him the question, do you think that, the president mishandled the early stages of the COVID reaction and, what should have been done, and what do you think? And Gottlieb said, well, I believe that the president was misserved by those around him, or he would have perhaps acted differently. And he went on to explain what he meant by that. And her response to him was, so you're going to let him off the hook. Now, this is a professional national show, and that is what the journalist asked Dr. Scott Gottlieb after he gave his honest opinion and assessment of the situation. So this is a perfect example. Now, she didn't lie by saying that, but her bias is so insidious in that question to him. And then she abruptly ended the interview. I was laughing out loud as I'm driving down the road in my Jeep thinking, people must look at me and say I'm nuts for laughing and there's nobody else in the car. But let me tell you, I couldn't believe my ears. What do you think?
Well, absolutely. And so what we have is, I've just read Woodward's book, at least the important parts about COVID. And what you find is, even though his lead in to try to sell books is that Trump didn't tell us about this or that, the fact is that if you read his book and the facts he details in it, without trying to act like they really helped Trump out.
Well, just to, before you go any further, isn't the retort there to Woodward when he makes that accusation of the president? What's your excuse for not telling us? If you found out this was so tragic, why did you wait till, September, an election year, to tell us about it? Were you raking in more money for your book, buddy? I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
But here's my point. My point
that there was really nothing. If you go back, and I didn't even remember this well, because I thought Woodward's BS in this, but I went back, and the idea that Trump did not tell us about the lethality, the deadliness of the disease is so out of kilter. The country was up in arms before we had a case in the United States, and certainly before we had a death, which happened February 29th. Before we had a death, the first death was February 29th, we were sold out of hand sanitizers and the other wipes and almost masks. We were sold out of them. Why?
And toilet paper for sure. I don't know why.
Paper. That's right, toilet paper. But we were sold out of these before there was the first death. And you look at Woodward's book, and like I say, is Woodward's claims are different from the facts in his book. When you go into the facts in his book, if anything, the Democrats were trying to act like Trump was fear-mongering. It's not just Joe Biden who said he's fear-mongering. But the fact is, most people in the country, everybody was up, realizing that this could be really strong. Now, we didn't know. Everybody thought this was lethal. Most people overestimated, according to a Stanford study I just read, that most people had underestimated the lethality of this disease, overestimated it. And we were wild. We thought we could just get from touching a package or something, and that 5% of us were going to die, and that 6 million of us were going to die. So nobody, even before anything was shut down, we knew more than we needed to know, and we were more afraid than we should have been. But you can't accuse Trump. And as a matter of fact, they tried to accuse Trump of being a fearmonger. Now, 6 months later, they tried to act like just the opposite. Oh, Trump tried to act like we were, nothing was going on here. The fact is, Trump understood that we were panicking. We were panicking. He was trying to be kind of soft about it. But like Anthony Fauci said, February 9th, a month before the country was shut down, Fauci gave a briefing with Robert Redfield, the CDC, to the 25 state governors. And Fauci said, I think we scared the shit out of them. Now, and I think that's true.
Yep.
The country was scared shitless. Excuse my language.
It's okay. We're not regulated by the FCC, but we are trying to stay radio friendly because I might get picked up by a radio station. But go ahead.
But my point is, I'm just really reflecting what Anthony Fauci said. I read a Stanford study that was commissioned by an international public health group that said as of February 23, everyone in the country knew how the disease was spread. They knew it was through saliva and airborne. They knew that you shouldn't touch your nose, mouth, or face. They understood it came from China. They thought it was a 5% lethality. They thought that children were subject to it. They were overly worried about the consequences. So the central charge of Woodward's book is that Trump did not tell us that this thing was lethal or that it was dangerous. That's absolutely the opposite.
Are you seeing a pattern there with Woodward there, John?
Right. He's trying to sell a book because the funny thing about it is he says all this in the first five pages of his prologue, and then he goes out and he sells the book. But when you read the book, which I have read, he goes through various facts, and basically on February 1st or February 2nd, I forget which, after Trump does his government shutdown, the Times and the Post blast it on their front page and try to make it look like Trump is hyping it too much, but they nonetheless put it out there in the public deal. February 9th, the briefing of the governors, everybody is going wild. So the fact is that the country was up on edge, but what we didn't know, and nobody knew because China was not talking to us, and Woodward actually does a good job of showing that China won't tell us anything. We don't know anything, and we are waiting for information, and we're not going to shut down the country just on a whim. But at the same time, we're all watching and waiting, and the fact is that when you read Woodward's book, in the facts that he presents, there's nothing more Trump actually comes out to any critical thinker looking very good.
Indeed.
And that is the problem. He did everything right. And Fauci said he did everything right. And so every now and then, when panic is setting in and people are going bananas, my daughter is a very high executive with a big national company, and her workers just made fun of her because she would not come into work without a mask, and she was doing all this stuff. Oh, they made fun of her. The fact is, people were scared out of their skulls.
Right. And Trump, people are still very, very frightened of this thing. And the propaganda to perpetuate that fear is, in my view, purposeful and very, very effective. And we're fortunate that we have the leadership in our government right now who has been a couple of steps ahead of that and actually saved us from disaster. Now, whether they can carry us through and get us through to the end where everybody's not freaked out anymore is yet to be seen, but I certainly hope so. John, you've been so generous with your time. I want you to go ahead and wrap it up, and then I want to let you go here because we've been on over an hour, and it's nice to have the latitude to do that, but I don't want to be a hog with your precious time. So why don't you finish up with what you want the audience to know, and then we'll definitely do this again. So go ahead. We're talking with Mr. John O'Connor. The book is Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. And boy, if there was, it's such a prescient subject. My brother just told me, John, today, well, why do you want to talk about Watergate? That happened 50 years ago. I said, listen, what it started a chain of events that is amplified today. So if you want to expound upon that or anything else, Mr. John O'Connor, go ahead.
Well, that's right. If you understand what happened in Watergate, you understand what's happening today. And essentially, now let me give you one more thing. When Trump was trying to get us ready for the crisis, all the left was poo-pooing it as being a fearmonger. Now what happens is, now we have to shut down, and the left goes the opposite extreme. The left now sees this as an opportunity to shut everything down. Whereas in fact, you have to be balanced. You have to be, worried about it at the beginning. But at the same time, think about it. A nail salon in California is just opening now. Why couldn't they have opened 4 months ago?
15 days to slow the spread, don't you know?
Right, exactly. Why couldn't we have done this 5 months ago? Because the liberals got involved, and now they went the other way, and now they tried to make Trump look bad that way. The fact is, he handled it in the right way. He let us all know. We all got on edge. And at the same time, he was saying, we got to shut down, but then let's open up. Now, when we look back on this, we will see that he handled the thing very well. Now, he's not the greatest speaker, the most BS guy in the world, but he handled it well. And that's why I want everybody to read Postgate. And the reason I want to read Postgate is because it defines our modern history of journalism and politics and how they intersect. And that's everything today is how journalism and politics intersects. And once you understand it, you will understand what's happening today. JD, I can't tell you how with such insightful comments you've made today blow me away. And I thank you so much for what you're doing. So thank you. And I appreciate being on your show. You've got a great show.
Well, thank you, John. It's been an absolute pleasure and an edification of me and my audience. And I want to thank you for being so generous with your time. I'm going to keep your phone number, sir, and we're going to have to do this again as things continue to...
Please call me anytime. Please call me anytime, and I hope I can give you better audio next time. Okay, buddy?
Yes. John O'Connor, everybody. The book is Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and began today's partisan advocacy journalism. John O'Connor, thank you so much. Have a good night, sir. Stay safe and God bless America.
Thank you, buddy.
All right. So what we're going to do, folks, is we're going to finish that video I started, and then we're going to come back and get some of your comments. So don't you go anywhere, okay? It's JD. It's Article 5 Live. We have, in fact, some of the best guests on the internet. We don't have the biggest audience yet, but you guys are going to help me grow that because we have something to say here on Article 5 Live. And I want to thank you for being there, and we're going to hit the video in just a bit. Here we go.
Dr. Ray, earlier you confirmed Antifa does indeed exist, but you considered it more of an ideology than a group, correct?
Yes, an ideology or maybe a movement.
And this is an ideology that organizes locally. It coordinates regionally and nationally. It wears a standardized uniform. It collects funds to buy high-powered lasers to blind federal officers, build homemade explosive devices, feed their rioters since they clearly aren't working, and then bail out those who've been arrested. This is an ideology that has trained its members, makes shield wall phalanxes to attack federal officers. It formed an autonomous zone in an American city and besieged a federal courthouse in another. So, I mean, it just seems to be more than an ideology.
There's not a material support to offense like there is. You know, we could do material support to Al-Qaeda or ISIS. There's not a material support to a domestic terrorism.
We did apply for a grant from Soros at Webridge a long time ago. We actually did get a grant from them. There is going to be a need for thousands of people and then millions to come into the streets. Contributing money is a huge... Look, we are not going to reach millions without millions. That's just straight up. We are not going to do it. We need millions of dollars to reach millions of people.
A group or individuals that control Antifa and have some authority over it, and it is to some degree without question organized. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think what I would say is that we have seen folks who subscribe to or self-identify with the Antifa movement who coalesce regionally into what we refer to or think of as more as small groups or nodes. And they're certainly organized at that level.
Just in the number of either cases or arrests, how many of them are white supremacists?
Within the domestic terrorism bucket category as a whole, racially motivated violent extremism is, I think, the biggest bucket within that larger group. And within the racially motivated violent extremist bucket, ascribing to some kind of white supremacist type ideology is certainly the biggest chunk of that.
Okay,
I don't
that's
have
very
numbers
helpful.
For you.
That's very helpful. Yeah. So the white supremacists are the largest chunk of the racially motivated.
Yes.
Keith Ellison was talking about white supremacists who have dressed up in black, who have camouflaged themselves to look like somebody black and going around knocking out windows. They showed them. And they should, they are now investigating this. And I will tell him that there are a lot of people subverting the Black Lives Matter movement. The Black Lives Matter movement is trying to show this country the way to go when it comes to law enforcement.
The violence in most of the cities is precipitated by sort of hardened extremists who come equipped for battle. And they are, by and large, extreme left-wing Marxist people who want to bring down and tear down the current system. There are also some, I would say, pure anarchists who don't necessarily want to build a Marxist system. It's not clear what they want to build, but they definitely want to tear down the system.
Some of the charging documents, though, do refer to people that are, for example, the Boogaloo Boys. So we do see the radical right charges.
Well, Boogaloo is not radical right, and that's one of the misconceptions that's being, essentially perpetuated by the media. They are people who believe that the system, current system, has to be torn down and completely replaced. People join it for different reasons. Some have different visions of what the future should look like, but they're all in agreement it should be torn down.
So they're leftist Boogaloo Boys?
They're anarchists.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sedition is a cancer, and its metastatic path winds up in unexpected places. What we're seeing isn't a redress of grievances. Criticism of the government is a part of our First Amendment. What's actually happening now is that concerned Americans are being punished for speaking out against those with the power to carry out subversion of our Constitution. So, when the Attorney General and the Executive Office are largely criticized for pointing out the treason, you have to ask yourself, how far gone is this republic? John Bound reporting.
Thank you very much, Charlie. And we're back on Article 5 Live, hoping that you guys enjoyed Mr. John O'Connor, who, any of you that's been around, remember him, because he was all over the news media at several different times in the, you know, the 2000s and before, you know, and yeah, for a whole decade, going back and forth with this deep throat thing. And so the book Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism. It's a fascinating read. I have to admit, I've only been through a third of the book, but you know, it's available on Amazon or whenever great books are sold. I highly suggest it, because even though the Watergate is 50 years old, what the media is doing is absolutely relevant. And that's why I wanted to bring John O'Connor to you. And man, what an interview. What a guy. This guy really knows what he's doing. Now, we have a lot of comments that you guys were making during the show. And I know the audio was horrible at the beginning of the show. I apologize that. I had to move to Bluetooth, for goodness sake, to make it better. Imagine that. So, Mike Vplex commented, Nixon was a saint compared to Obozo. As you heard from Mr. John O'Connor, Richard Nixon had no idea this stuff was being done. And then told, everybody said it was done on his behalf. It was the CIA who pulled all this off in order to deflect from the naughty boys being caught doing what they do. Very interesting stuff. It's just fascinating. So if anybody would like to make any comments, I'd love to have your feedback on our guest, John O'Connor, and anything you want to talk about that he had to say. Now, the other thing, we were supposed to have Bobby Lawrence on. For some reason, I couldn't get a hold of him. It is late on the East Coast, so I don't know that he was not otherwise engaged, but he was supposed to be on tonight. We'll get Bobby Lawrence on so he can tell us about National Popular Vote Compact Progress by the enemy known as the Democrats. And also, we will ask Bobby what's the real story about Trump's popularity and chances in the great state of Pennsylvania. And he has a good finger on the pulse of the politics of that state, and he can give us a true picture because he is paying quite a bit of attention. And Mike says, yeah, he took a hit for them. I don't know what happened to all the curiosity of the American public. Are we just lazy? Are we incurious about authorities, especially people in the news media? I don't know what happened. I've never bought into any of it. I've always been skeptical about anything I've been told, which has really, frankly, gotten me in a lot of trouble in a lot of cases, because I should have been listening to some people and shouldn't have listened to other people that I did listen to. But right, Mike, Nixon is the one that took the hit. He didn't know what they were doing. He was convinced by John Dean to cover it up. And, you know, also, Nixon was fiercely loyal to his staff. Even if they were doing something wrong, he didn't want them to take the fall. I don't want to paint Richard Nixon out as a saint, but he was nowhere nearly as bad as what the press made him out to be. Now, I don't agree with a lot of Nixon's foreign policy. In fact, the globalist crap that went on in the Nixon administration makes me want to pull what little hair I have left out. But Richard Nixon did not deserve what the CIA basically did to him with Watergate. And people don't even know that's what happened. So I want you to read the book Postgate by John O'Connor. And I think you will find it a fascinating read. I'm going to finish reading it. Yeah, and Mike just says he agrees with what John O'Connor said. Well, you know, if there's anybody to listen to about this, it's John O'Connor, because he was there. He has many, many interactions with Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein, other names, and most importantly, Mark Felt, who is the assistant director of the FBI, also known as Deep Throat, known him for decades before he died. So, yeah, you might call John O'Connor the foremost authority on all these subjects. And he felt compelled after all these years, because of all the things going on, to, you know, when they chopped his head off and threw it in the dumpster, as John put it, he decided to write the book and tell everybody everything he knew. So I suggest reading Postgate. I think it's going to be, you won't regret doing that. Now, is there anyone else that would like to comment on anything tonight who is still with me? The chat is open. I'd love to hear your comments on Mr. O'Connor. And we will get Bobby Lawrence. I know a lot of you guys know Bobby Lawrence. We'll get him on the show as well. And we did go long with John, but, you know, I'm not going to, when I get a guy that knows what he knows and has been where he's been, willing to come on this show and tell us what he's, you know, speak his mind with us, I'm just not going to shut him off. Okay. So, you know, it's nice to have the latitude to be able to run long like that. I know it's hard to listen for that many minutes, but I want to thank you guys that hung in there with me. Let's see. Mike is the only one giving me comments, you guys. He was great on here tonight. It's 12:30 here, though. Yeah, I know. It is late. I'm going to shut the show down. I want to tell you guys that I absolutely appreciate each and every one of you. I'm going to have a great show next week. I think I have Janine Pirro an interview scheduled with her. It'll air. And I will also have a friend of mine and a great talent, Von Wiehunt, the host of the Von Wiehunt Show, will be with us next week on Article 5 Live. Keep a lookout for Article 5 Extra during the week, where I will, you know, be commenting on various things. Things are happening so quick. I hate staying off the air for a whole week. I want to pop in there and, you know, comment on some things. So may God continue to bless you, your family, these United States of America. May he protect our great president. I'll be back live on the internet next Sunday, 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 Eastern, with the best 90 minutes in digital media. Article 5 Live. Until then, it's JD signing off. Be safe and God bless. We'll be right back.